So just to tell you what we're doing today, we're looking at Noether theorems, but I will probably not do a ton of examples, but this afternoon we'll do the computations in Yangmin's theory about what I'm doing today. So there will be all the time to look at the details and see how it works. So maybe because I kind of want to get it done, I might take a particle example instead of a field theoretic example, just to make things a bit clear, explicit. Okay. So last time, remember we did see that we started from a Lagrangian, which is a top zero form. And from these, we derive the equations of motion and theta. So theta is a top one form of the source type, which is proportional to delta phi, but without any derivative acting on the variation of the field. So we decomposed. What we did was to decompose L as E plus dt. And theta is a top minus one form that it's a boundary term of the variation. And it's this our covariant symplectic potential current. A long name. And the reason it's so long and I didn't want to make it shorter is that it's a current because it's a top minus one form on space-time. So it's like a vector. This is the every current is even the electric current is a top minus one form or a vector field, depending on whether you want to dualize it. It's a symplectic potential because it looks a bit like the symplectic potential that we saw, but it's not quite. So I want to stick to that covariant name because to obtain a symplectic potential, one has to work quite hard. So, but morally speaking, it's the symplectic potential of our theory. So from that, we defined also omega, which is the covariant symplectic current, or maybe I called it covariant symplectic form current, but for the same reason, it's a current because it's also a top minus one form, but is it on space-time, but is a two form on field space, just like the symplectic form. And what we saw, the theorem that we proved, which was not too hard, was to prove that d omega is actually conserved on shell, which allowed us to say that the space of on-shell fields with omega sigma, which is the integral of this top minus one form, so maybe I should put so this is integrated, this is a form on space-time. So this one is pretty much like our phase space. Right? With the space of on-shell fields on a given surface. This is what allows us to give that interpretation. This is a Cauchy surface for our space-time, and we integrate this current on the surface in a two form on F. Now there's no form part on M anymore. Sorry for all the omegas, there's not a lot one can do about that. Okay, so this was last time. Today we introduce symmetries. So is it clear so far? You remember what was the reasoning for the values? So since this is conserved, this structure does not really depend on sigma. That was the important. And so this is kind of defined abstractly independently of the choice of the Cauchy slice. And this is a space of on-shell histories, which is also can be thought of the space of initial data on that surface. And these two things go together and talk to the tutorial. And so kind of the intuition is that. Okay. So today we look at symmetries. And I call them Lagrangian symmetries, because their main properties is that they leave the Lagrangian unchanged. So let's consider, so now I introduce another weird symbol, is a frac G. So capital, one needs to get creative with the Blackbird typeface. So we have this G, which is a Lie algebra. I put it capital because later I want it to be defined at every point in spacetime. So it's a local object. Like in Young-Mills theory, I can choose my gauge parameter locally. So that's why I don't want it to call it small g, because that would be a finite one, and this is infinite dimensional. Okay, so we have this Lie algebra, and as in the first part of the course, what we want to do, is to have an action of our Lie algebra on field space. This is a vector. This is an action. And the action, remember, the main property was that the bracket here is mapped on the bracket there. So it's a homomorphism of Lie algebra. So we want that rho of psi eta is equal to rho psi. This is what the symmetry is. And to be a Lagrangian symmetry, we take such an action, and we want it to leave our Lagrangian invariant. Of L. So should I put it to zero? Well, that's a strong statement. What is enough is that the Lagrangian is invariant up to boundary terms. Because, in fact, the equations of motion of the theory do care only about the bulk part of the variation of L. So since this is actually our guy, like the what makes things physical, in quote, even L is just in reality defined up to boundary terms. But we suppose we have chosen one. And so what we do is to say this is invariant up to an exact. Okay, does this add up? So for example, in gravity, the Lagrangian is not strictly speaking invariant, it gives you a boundary term. There is a total divergence appearing. So this is the most general case, and this is what I call a Lagrangian symmetry. So these are, let's say what it is. It's a top minus one. So this is top. This doesn't change the degree of the form. So there is a D, so it's a top minus one form on spacetime, and the zero form on field space. If we want, this is a bit mathematically a bit vague, but it's okay for us. We can say that this is valued in the dual, in the sense that the left-hand side is linear in Xi. This must also be linear in Xi, so valued in the dual. But if we don't want to think about this, we just say this is like that and linear in Xi. It's the same thing. So it's just repackaging things left to right. So this is maybe easier. Okay. Now, now we get to the point. We have all the ingredients, and we prove Noether theorem. Noether one. So we start with the definition of the Noether current. I put it inside the theorem or out. It doesn't really matter. So the definition is J of Xi is equal to this. So this is just the definition. What am I doing? I'm taking my symplectic potential that comes out of the Lagrangian. I evaluate it on a field variation. So I replace d phi inside here with its gauge transform. And I subtract, in case the Lagrangian is not exactly invariant, I need to correct. Now the statement is that this Noether current is conserved on shell. So the fact that I'm using J as a symbol is not, and I use J in the first part of the course for the Hamiltonian generator, of course, is related. You probably remember a formula like this for the generators. And that will be the next result. So let's prove this just as an application of our formalism. The way to do it is to compute the variation of the Lagrangian in two different ways. So we know that by definition, it can be written, we say it's this object, or the other way to compute it is to say, no, but wait a second. I know that dl is e d theta, and so I use that. Remember, by Cartan's formula, this is equal to that. The other term is not there because L is a zero form, so there's nothing to contract. And here I plug in my definition. So this is E. E plus E, well, let me put the D first. So we see immediately that comparing the left and right hand side, we find an equation of this sort, more precisely. Therefore, we get a more precise statement. In fact, what we find is that DJ is given by minus this. Yes. So let me write this. So if E is equal to by E, this guy is just in component would be delta xi of phi. Because again, this is just proportional to d phi. So it's clearly on shell this guy vanishes. Because it's proportional to my equations of motion, so there's no doubt that this would be zero on shell. So Let's take a second. So we have proven that to each Lagrangian symmetry, we can associate a conservative. That's what we usually learn about Noether theorem. And this is just the first part. There's more to come. So what do we want to say about this? As before, here, I used the fact that this was a conserved current to define an object associated to a sigma that is conserved, that is constant, essentially. So here we can do the same. I will call it Q.
Hello.
Could you
repeat why it is zero?
I will say that. I just What is zero? So these are the equations of motion.
Okay.
And my wiggly equal, which is called also weak equality, just means that it's valid on shell of the equations. Okay. When those vanish. So maybe at this point it's good to have a little example just to. Okay, here it is. And this is my charge. I call this charged. And this is what is conserved. If I'm in the situation where sigma has no boundaries, then Q of sigma in initial is the same as Q of sigma final, evaluated on the same symmetry parameter. So here the situation is, remember, the potatoes. And this is sigma out final. This is sigma initial. This is my M in between. And xi. Well, here depends, of course, if I have a global symmetry, xi is really quite the same. And later we will explore in the case of a local symmetry where I can choose xi independently of the location, what this implies. But that will come next. For now, let's look at the case of a global symmetry. Sample. So we take our Lagrangian to be sum of minus, it's not too relevant, but let's put something quite general here. So this is a particle system. So it's a field theory in 0 plus 1 dimension. The only, it's a bit of a weird think of a weird way of thinking about a particle problem. But since we integrate over dt only, it's like having a zero dimensional sigma and only time. And the field space is given by all these particles with all their components. They are bundled together in, they're all these field components that just depend on t. So space-time is hidden inside the definition of field space, inside, in a sense, in this case. So we can compute. We don't really look at the equations of motion. Those you know how to compute them, it's not too interesting here. So a theta. What is theta? It happens if I vary this, since it's the part that comes from integrations by part, it doesn't really see the potential. It just sees the kinematical term, and in fact gives, and nobody will be really surprised to see this, but this is I Q alpha I. So I'm contracting indices with the flat metric. So why I'm using this D? Because here I want to think of this as a field theory in this in one dimension, in 0 plus 1 dimension. So it's not the D that I had before. That was just a T constant. This is a field theoretic guy. This is a form that depends on time. So this is a top minus one, but since the dimension of M here is just one, this is a zero form on M cross, zero one form on M cross M. So M is just R time.
It shouldn't be Q dQ dot.
No, it's always like this, because what you're doing is to, so the way you write it, you have a term which is inside. So DL contains a term like this. But then what you write it like this. When you find the equations of motion, you pull this on this side, and the term that comes out is Q dot delta. So all quadratic Lagrangian give symplectic potential of this form, a velocity times the delta of the field. Now, the symmetry that we want to look at is rotations, and we had already seen it before. So this is alpha. Alpha is the particle that I'm looking at. Epsilon ijk, epsilon psi I, q alpha j, d over dq. So what is this symmetry? This is rotations, and my gauge parameter is so xi is a rotation, is SO3, but SO3 I write it as KI times some matrix that I would really like to call J, but probably is a bad idea. And let's just say that this is, as a vector space, it's just R3. So this is psi.
Maybe instead of D, it's better to write delta, right? Because it's
you're right. Yes, you're right. This is really like this. You're absolutely right. And this is global in this case, in the rotation case, so it doesn't depend on T. You're right. I should correct my... Okay, so now the Lagrangian is clearly invariant under this. There's no boundary term coming out. So R in this case is zero, and we can just compute our parent as I rho psi theta. And this, what do we expect it to be, is also a top minus one form, so it's also a zero form it's a zero, zero form. So it will look like a function in this case. And doing the computation, what we need to do is to replace this quantity at the place of this, right? Because this is how I'm contracting this vector field with this form. So this with that gives me a bunch of delta functions, which just mean that I have to plug in this guy instead of here, making, well, maybe calling this index k. So it's this gives me exactly that. And now I can just plug this in. So this is the sum alpha m alpha q alpha dot k epsilon ij k psi I q alpha k. And this also depends on t. And what we're saying is that, in fact, you recognize here angular momentum, right? This is equal to, this is the momentum, p alpha, and this is a cross product dotted with it. So this is p alpha cross q, well, q probably, if the signs are right, dotted with psi. So this is the total angular momentum. And of course, psi goes out of the sum. So it's really the total angular momentum that we're looking at. And what Noether theorem tells us is that dt of this quantity, because I'm taking the divergence, but there's only one direction, so this is just dt of j psi is equal to zero. Well, on shell. One needs equations of motion. Of course, there are off-shell histories that do not preserve angular momentum. Okay, so one last remark. If psi depended on time, then this wouldn't be true. So it's very important for this equation to hold, to have psi time independent. And last thing, this q is actually what one would call. So this is what? This is just some time t. It's just some value of my time. This is the value of the angular momentum at a given time. And we say that this is conserved by the dynamic. So in this case, there's not a ton of difference between j and q because our space-time is zero-dimensional, so there's nothing to integrate.
This is also a good example to see why no current symmetry doesn't have a current, right? Doesn't have a charge. Local symmetries, right? Because if it's dependent on time, so I don't have charge anymore. So it's
basically we will do this in a couple of minutes. Well, in 5 minutes. Okay. So I push this up. So are there questions about this example? Noether first. Now we move on to what we want to show is that angular momentum now generates rotations. We know it already for the particle, and I will not redo the computation, but I want to discuss under which hypothesis this is true in general. Okay? Change. File of notes. So, this is a bit tricky. So let me first give you the best case scenario. I call this the best case scenario lemma. Because it's the case that happens, for example, in Young-Mills theory, or in that case. And it very useful to build intuition, but it's not always. So it's kind of the model case that one keeps in mind, and then one adjusts the intuition based on the actual system one is looking at. So it's based on two hypotheses. The first one is that the Lagrangian, so if 1 and 2, the Lagrangian is invariant. So what does it mean? Well, this is just to say that R is zero. So we don't have to think about it. First thing to be nice. Second thing, we want theta to be invariant. So that theta is a contraction of vectors. It's invariant under rotation.
Do we need R to be 0?
Yeah, for this case. Well, you mean if it's in the cohomology, we are not bothering with that problem right now. We just say, if dr is 0, in this case, I just care about dr. But if dr is 0, it means that I can choose r equals 0 as well. So I just am not caring about those ambiguities for the moment. Then, of course, by just writing these through Cartan's formula, I find all the information I need. So then, J, then what do we have? We have that I rho xi omega is equal to minus dj. So if these two basic conditions are satisfied, and there are many cases in which they are, then we automatically get our flow equation. I call this the covariant Hamiltonian flow equation. And the proof is just Cartan's formula. There's really nothing to be done. And J, in this case, is just the contraction of theta with rho. And that's all there is. You see it?
Yeah.
It's just kind of. On two, let's say, on condition two, I apply there, plug in the definition of J, and it's. So this is our model case, but it's not always satisfied. Now, I will state the most general case. The proof is in the notes. It's not extremely instructive. In abstract, we will see in gravity how the different terms pop out. I don't think there's a ton of interest in going into the abstract proof during the classroom. So the general theorem so if we don't have, if you're not in the best case scenario, what can happen? What can go wrong? This is what I'm trying to answer here. So there's always a nice term like this. But there can also be extra terms. Well, I'm not so sure about signs. Yeah. So there can be two types of obstruction. So there is a corner obstruction here. And a bulk obstruction in a sense. Okay, so this is a top minus 1, comma 0 form, and this is a top minus, well, S is a top minus 2, comma 0 form. I'm leaving the D outside. Okay, so what are they? When they come up, that's kind of the interesting question. Well, it turns out that I can define R in where so it could be that my equations of motion as a form, this is important, as a form, are not really invariant. They are invariant up to a boundary term. So this looks weird. In gravity, this happens. Because this is a top form. This is a lead derivative. So there's always a total divergence popping out by anyway. So we will see that next week. But again, this is about the invariance of the equations of motion. There cannot be any bulk term because you see the symmetries respect anyway the bulk part of the Lagrangian, so one can show that there cannot be any bulk contribution to this equation. Because if this is a Lagrangian symmetry, it leaves the bulk part of the Lagrangian invariant, and E just knows about that bulk part of the Lagrangian, so there cannot, it must be invariant. But it, there can be some boundary term appearing. And S there is just the fact, is just due to this formula, which it's not very insightful, but I write it anyway just to say how things are defined. Maybe if I were smarter, I could figure out a more telling way of defining this object, but I couldn't see any. So it turns out that these two quantities minus that are related. They are related, but there could be also an extra corner term. So you see what's happening is that I have to run the cohomology machinery. So since D of something, D of these, what I find is that D of these must vanish, but the best I can conclude is that it is a total divergence itself, like an exact form itself. So you can find in the notes the proof of these two statements. I think they're not extremely enlightening in their own right, but it's so if you try to write these in terms of, you say, oh, let me try to understand this by using Cartan's formula here. Well, you end up on this equation again. So this equation and that are actually the same. So it looks a bit like the three-card game where I'm trying to cheat you, but we will see in gravity how to actually compute these two terms, and I will convince you that each term is interesting on its own way. So let's forget about this case until we look into gravity. Let's just remember that there is no guarantee a priori that the symmetry is Hamiltonian. There can be obstructions to that, unless one is in the best case scenario. Does the logic make sense? So this formula is cryptic. We will find an example where we can actually work out the different pieces. And this is kind of what we want to keep in mind for now. So just this is a simple observation. This term becomes so what do I want to say? If I'm off shell, so let me give the off-shell statement. This type of obstruction, if it's present, there's really nothing I can do. But if R is not there and I have S, when I integrate this on a surface without boundaries, S drops. So, and either I can either be on a boundary-less Cauchy surface or ds could be zero. In either case, omega sigma, well, sorry, I rho psi omega sigma is dq, right? So I could also do the on-shell case. The on-shell case, all equalities are replaced by weak equalities.
J instead of Q? J instead of Q?
No, I've integrated, I just call Q instead of the integral, yeah. Because it's just what people mostly use Q when it's integrated. Okay, so this is it. The case of rotations would of course fall into that lemma. Young-Mills theory that we will do this afternoon also falls into the best case scenario. And so until we next week, when we will do gravity, we will not see any example. Then gravity has both. Okay, So far, whether they were local or global symmetry didn't matter. So let's now jump into the local symmetries. So what a local symmetry is when my psi, I can actually choose it pointwise. So this psi is essentially a function valued in some finite dimensional Lie algebras. That's what usually happens. So this is an example. Could be like this. Gravity is a bit more subtle because this is mils. GR, what would be xi? Xi would be the vector fields on my manifold. But still, you can see that you can choose your vector field as you like, pointwise. Up to smoothness problems. Okay. So this is what we have in mind. The important thing is that I can have size of compact support. What does it mean? It means that I can do a gauge transformation here, and all the rest is left invariant. So we will now see what's the consequence of this fact.
In Yang-Mills, I didn't get what.
So let's say this is SU2. Just this is the case we will look this afternoon. So it's a function valued in SU2. Maxwell theory is just a real valued function. Is your lambda, the gauge transformation. In one case, in Maxwell is abelian, so it's just R. In Yang-Mills, in general, you can put SU2, SU3 if you're doing QCD, but it's a finite dimensional. Okay, so now we want. Everything I'm going to say will come out of this. I will just leverage this fact that now I can choose size of compact support and find out the consequences. Let me do a preliminary notation thing. Remember. I want to be a bit more explicit about what this is. So not very much. Just I want to say that this guy is some maybe I call it D. Is D a good idea? Maybe not. Maybe let's call it P. It's some differential operator. So that acts. We know that this is linear in psi. So I just call this P, whatever it is. And this is, however, in general, a first order differential operator. Let's give these two examples just to clarify what I'm talking about. So delta xi of A is equal to d psi. So this is, we're going to look into this afternoon, but this will be structure constants, alpha, beta, A, psi, gamma, right? So P, in this case, is A alpha, dA, delta, alpha, what am I doing? Because it's I here is both alpha and A, so that's why I was a little confused. So this is alpha A. Anyway, let me just do it for Maxwell theory. It's easier, and this afternoon we will do it anyway for Yang-Mills. So in this case, I just have this is equal to the derivative. Okay. In Yang-Mills, it's d plus a with the indices adjusted as it should. So maybe let's do it a bit formally. Psi. So this is this plus a. In quotes, and this afternoon we will just fix notation. So in general, it's a differential operator. So now what I need is the following. I will need to consider this kind of expression, because remember, it's my right-hand side of the first Noether first theorem. And I want to write it as, so now we have this. What if we integrate by part? So since I'm choosing integration by parts, I'm choosing xi of compact support. There are no boundary terms. So I can forget about boundary terms. That's the whole interest. And here I find some other operator, which is obtained by integrating by parts, which is the adjoint operator, just by definition. And you just compute it by integrating by parts, whatever this expression is. But now it's acting on the equations of motion. Does it make sense? So P dagger would be the same as this one, but with a minus sign here, because integrating by part, the partial derivative gets a minus sign. This doesn't do anything. You just move it to the left. It doesn't.
The boundary term vanishes because of compact support.
Yeah, boundary terms. We can forget them, because now we're dealing with these gauge transformations, with these local symmetries. And now we can state the theorem. This is Noether 2. And I might. So you see, I don't have to go much farther than this. Noether 2 says that guy vanishes identically. So pi alpha ei is equal to 0. And the proof, it's actually quite simple. I write it here. We did already all the heavy lifting. We just need to figure out what that is equal to. But we have Noether 1. So we have that the integral over m of dj of xi is equal to ei d xi by I, which is equal to I alpha ei psi alpha. But we know that, again, the thing I'm using is really this, the compact support. So this is a boundary term, but we don't care. It's just compact inside, whatever it is, however I choose my thing. So this is 0. Okay. So, and now we have that this is 0 for all size of compact support.
Yeah, that's.
And so this must vanish. This is the only possible way. Okay. So this, since this is linear now, so the operator is acting on this guy. So this is linear. This integral. This is linear in psi. And vanishes for all size of compact support. Therefore, we conclude. So it's just, we get that identity. Does it make sense? It's the same way you compute your Lagrange equations of motion. you have something which is linear in the variation. You say the variation is arbitrary, therefore the part in front of it must vanish. Same reasoning, except that here I'm using psi for my freedom. So what's the meaning of this theorem? It looks a bit cryptic, but it's actually very important. It says, it's telling us, there's a surprise here. It's telling us that the equations of motions are not all independent. What does that mean? It means that I will not be capable of evolving all my fields. So I have less equations of motion than fields.
How do we see that?
So for every alpha pointwise, so that's an identity. It's not that they're zero on shell or anything. It just says that there is a linear relationship between some equations of motion. Oh, and sorry, these are called Bianchi identities, I should have said. These are the Bianchi identities. So what this is saying is that there are not enough equations of motion to propagate all the fields.
Can be a differential operator, right?
Yeah. But from a counting perspective, it's in all interesting cases, it is a differential operator.
Yep.
But it's still saying that some equations are redundant. They don't give any new information.
If we take two independent equations, we can still construct if it was combination of equations.
So look, it is a linear combination of equations. That's a linear operator. It's a differential one, but it's still a linear operator. So then I agree. Maybe one should be careful about the actual theory one is looking at. But this is saying that, you see, we have the fields are counted by how many eyes I have. And there are just as many equations of motion a priori. But then there are also, there's one Bianchi identity for every alpha. So this is maybe B of alpha is a combination of the field, which is automatically zero without me asking anything. So what happens is that I have I minus alpha, this is super sketchy, independent equations of motion. So this means that the evolution of the fields is underdetermined given initial data, there are many solutions. More solutions. In fact, I have an infinite freedom. And what is that freedom? It's gauge freedom, essentially. So this is kind of telling us that if we want, from a system with local symmetries, to extract predictions, we need to identify configurations which are related under a local symmetry. I'm not proving this statement, but let's leave it as is, just as a moral conclusion. We need to identify configurations related by a local symmetry. This conclusion is not there for global symmetries, it's just there for local ones. And identify means is in a strong sense. You take equivalence classes, right? So that's, we know this, but usually it's said as a postulate. But in fact, it comes out from demanding that your dynamics, that whatever you can observe must be in this defined by the equivalence class. Otherwise, you cannot predict it. Okay, so this is the consequence of Noether's second theorem. Then the rest, I think it should be a small bit. So the rest is actually, I can do it quickly, and because I will not actually do the proofs, they are a bit, one is easy and one you need to do a 3+1 split, so it's a little annoying and it's in the notes. And I think they're also part of Noether's original theorem, except that I haven't double checked, so I'm not calling them, I'm calling these Noether 2, but probably also the rest is in Noether's original paper because there was really a lot in there. Okay, so I call it, let me call this the constraints lemma. And this is what Amir was mentioning. So remember, we had that and let's consider sigma without boundary. So we are in this situation, and we say that Q sigma of Xi, this was essentially Noether 1, which is the integral of J over sigma. Did I say, well? This guy by Noether 1, sorry, I put it in the wrong place, is independent of sigma. Constant in the sense that it is independent of the choice of sigma, right? Here or there is the same, it's conserved. That's a conservation of Noether theorem. But now I can choose my Xi on sigma in completely independently of Xi on sigma out. There's no reason why.
Yeah.
So, but now, if Xi is a local symmetry, I can choose Xi at sigma out equals zero. My compact support is on sigma and not on sigma. And therefore, the only value these charges can take is zero, right? If it's constant, and if I put Xi equal to zero and one, I get zero. The only value that they can take is zero. So this implies that Q sigma of Xi is zero. Sorry, this was conserved on shell. I apologize. This is really important. So this is not identically zero. This is zero. So this means that the current I started from has a bulk part that vanishes on shell, plus some boundary terms that do not enter this expression because sigma. So by looking again at this expression, I can conclude that jxi can be written as c psi plus dj of xi, where this vanishes on shell. In fact, I can prove something a bit stronger than that. I can prove that C is linear in Xi. Linear in the sense that is actually Xi alpha C alpha of Phi. There's no derivative acting on Xi. Okay, so So all the derivatives can be put in here. And this is a way to compute this. I wanted to do this. I need let me be a bit careful first. So this is true on sigma. I'm just talking about sigma here, one surface. And this is like this. So I want to break this in two statements. And I call this guy the constraint. Again, this afternoon, we will see what it is in Young-Mills theory, which is the typical example. Constraint. This will be the Gauss constraint. This will be the divergence of your electric field.
But slightly, actually, that really define the conserved quantity is choosing one, whatever psi, right?
Yeah, but it's totally free. It's true for any psi. In your symmetry.
Yeah, for any psi, that quantity is conserved. So if we chose a psi in our epsilon in, computed that, shouldn't we use the same psi there? Only then they are equal.
So let's look where it was coming from. I'm noter one over there. What I'm doing is seeing, I'm taking any psi, and I'm seeing whether the Lagrangian is invariant. And from that invariance equation, I find out that the divergence of J psi is zero on shell.
Yeah.
Now, this psi is any psi I wish on M, is a psi on M, not on sigma. That psi that entered the theorem is a psi defined on my spacetime menu.
Yes, yeah.
So now, you see, I can choose it as a like on spacetime. So I can choose it that if the symmetry is local, that it vanishes up here but not down there.
Ah, okay.
I just take a, you know, you see?
Choose some psi, which is
exactly
zero at one of the sigmas.
Precisely.
Then that quantity becomes zero throughout.
Yeah.
But still, only for that particular psi, which is zero on one for sigma, right?
No, but then I can choose another. So I can choose any psi that I like here, and zero still up there.
Okay.
So for any psi, this is equal to that. So it means that this has to vanish for any psi chosen.
Any psi would have to go to, means like you pick two psis, psi one, psi two, psi one becomes psi
okay.
one, and psi two both are non-zero.
You see the difference is that this is a psi on M.
Yeah.
And this is psi restricted to sigma out.
Okay.
And now psi, this is the one restricted on sigma. And basically, he's saying that sigma in, let's say.
Yeah.
But now, I can change my psi down here while keeping it zero up there.
I see.
And therefore, this is true for any sigma of any psi on my initial surface.
So you can,
you see?
On one, you can change slightly, keeping this projection still the same.
And so what I do here is the same thing I did before, in fact. What I'm doing to prove this theorem is say, okay, let me isolate psi, the linear piece. The rest I can integrate by part, and there's no boundary, so I can just throw it away. And since psi of compact support is arbitrary, it means that whatever it's multiplying in this expression must vanish on shell, because the equality is true only on shell. So this is how I extract this and the fact that it's linear. I'm applying the same reasoning that I did there. Since everything is compact support, I can neglect boundary terms. I integrate by parts until I isolate this guy. And whatever I have there is the actual thing that is vanishing here. Maybe I should do it more slowly, but at this point, I'll do it next time.
Okay.
Yeah.
By constraint, you mean this Bianchi identity, right? What do you mean by that constraint?
Of course, they are related. They're not. So this is identically zero. It's not something that is zero on shell. That's just a zero equals zero kind of equation. So in electromagnetism, it would be this equation. It says F is anti-symmetric. So it means that your equations of motion there are not as many as you think there are. There are not four of them because there's one that is trivial because it has to.
So what happens in that case for C?
C, in that case, so this C, but I mean, for young males, we will see it.
Constraint,
oh, this is the Gauss constraint. Is the divergence of the electric field, which is zero on shell, is this equation here. And finally, well, I mean,
divergence of field.
Oh, but that's because it's automatically embedded into the. If I write electromagnetism in terms of A, I'm doing that to. You see, this is B, and so its divergence, well, the fact that B is divergence free is just the fact that this form is exact. So it's embedded into the formalism. It's not a new equation from this perspective.
It's kind of like part of the equation of motion, similar to constraint, right? Because divergence of E.
So, yeah, what one calls constraint technically is on the canonical data, an equation of motion that contains no time derivative. So in reality, something that is telling you that the initial data have to satisfy some condition, even before being evolved. And usually, well, in all cases of this sort, that thing is automatically preserved by, that condition is automatically preserved by the equations of motion. So you impose it at the beginning, and then, in fact, this is telling you that there are n Bianchi identities, and there are as many constraints. So it means that you have whatever number of degrees of freedom you thought you have, minus 2n with the 2. Because there are both the constraints and the Bianchi identities that you have to keep. So that's where the origin of that 2, which is a bit confusing sometimes, it's because you have to do both. OK, so that's, yeah.
I know we have to go, so I'll keep it quick. I feel like what we should know is that the charge has to be like topological because not every vector field I pick, it might not be possible to like smoothly deform it to zero or something.
Okay, good. If you have a So the way I've defined things implicitly, well, I haven't really defined them carefully, but these infinitesimal symmetries are contractible by definition. So that doesn't really happen. They are beside this framework. Since I'm looking at infinitesimal symmetries, that just cannot really happen. However, if you are interested in looking at the group of symmetries instead of the algebra, then you have to be careful that there could be extra things that come out that are non-contractible, and therefore you might not be able to run this type of argument. I mean, you need to be careful about how you run. But I would say, for me, the way I understand it, and I think this can be substantiated, for example, in QCD when one looks at the actual the U1 problem of the actual axial current, then whether instantons are important and so on, you could argue that the the different non-connected connected components of the gauge, what you would call the gauge group, should be understood as global symmetries. So each piece is a gauge. But the fact that there are many pieces, that should be understood more like as a global kind of symmetry, which layers your fail space into sectors. Like that, you have a charge that tells you in which sector you are, which is not necessarily zero.
That makes sense.